Hello, welcome to the 29th episode of the Film Stage Podcast. I'm Jordan Raup.
I'm Dan Mecca.
And this episode, we're going to talk about Jimmy Hayward's Jonah Hex and Lee Unkrich's Toy Story 3.
But two very different movies.
Yes. And even critic-wise,
yeah,
and box office-wise.
Yeah, literally every single way. Very different.
Except they both have a Western
theme. Yeah, well, yeah, they both have cowboys now. Yeah.
And
that's one.
Got one. All right, well, let's jump into news stories first. First news story, a few days ago we found out that Tom Tyker.
Yep, sure.
He is behind Run Lola Run, and most recently The International.
Yeah, and a couple of better movies in between, like Perfume and Heaven.
Yes, and and the next film he's planning, which we reported on at least a few months ago, was
Cloud Atlas.
Cloud Atlas, yeah, an adaptation of David Mitchell's novel. Have you read it?
No, I have not. Actually, remind me what it is about, because I know it's very intriguing.
It's a project with six main characters that span thousands of years and several different genres. I'm not sure specifically, but that just sounds kind of...
Yeah, great. I mean, there's definitely something to it that reminded me a little bit of, ironically enough, something that Ayn Rand would write, like Atlas Shrugged or The Fountainhead, just kind of a wide-encompassing, politically inclined kind of a thing, that obviously accompanied, inputted some sort of fantasy element. And I say ironically just because Atlas Shrugged went into production like a week ago with its huge $5 million budget and no name list of stars and Gossip Girl director. Or One Tree Hill director, sorry. But anyway, looking at it now, it looks
The six
vast.
Stories, it takes place like from 1850 and then it goes all the way up to a post-apocalyptic future. So it's like... sounds crazy. And I would love for him to do a project like this. I mean, compared to something that felt kind of standard, with kind of a standard thriller.
The International. The International definitely was probably his weakest film. He hasn't made too many films, but that probably was definitely just something that clearly he didn't have full control over.
But the actual specific news story from last week was that rules for the film have been offered, which, I mean, doesn't mean much, but they're out there.
It's nice to know people are getting it.
And Tom Hanks, Natalie Portman, Halle Berry, James McAvoy, and Ian McKellen have all been offered roles.
Yeah, I would like... It would be nice to see Tom Hanks in kind of a risky role. I feel like he hasn't made a movie in which he took a risk in a long time. I can't even, really recall. I mean, I guess Castaway was kind of a risk. Just because he was the only actor in the movie, essentially. But really, there hasn't been much lately from him. You know, those crappy Ron Howard,
Charlie
Dan Brown, adaptations, what I mean? Charlie Wilson's War, but I mean, even that, that's just kind of,
Not really.
Nothing much, so it's kind of, it would be nice to see him make a movie, especially with kind of an auteurish director like Twicker, who's, German, and he just has a very distinct style if you've watched his movies.
Definitely.
And I mean, Natalie Portman always seems up to the task of taking risks, and that's, I think, why what we really appreciate her as an actor. So, I'm looking at that. Wow, Halle Berry, James McAvoy.
I'm sure none of these. I mean, in terms of the stories, they don't really interconnect in terms of characters. So.
Right. Well, yeah.
So that'd be like a kind of a New York, I love you.
An Altman kind of.
Altman thing. Yeah, no, that's true.
Yeah.
So we'll keep you updated on that project. I'm sure it'll take a while to get off the ground, but
it's good that he's working on something.
Yeah. And not too many news stories this week, so just one more we're going to talk about. A few months ago, we reported that Clint Eastwood, yes, was setting up a project. Dustin Lance Black, who wrote Milk, and he has his directorial.
What's Wrong with Virginia coming up?
Yep.
Which he has directorial debut. Wrote too.
And then Leo DiCaprio is attached to star, and now we confirm that he will be doing it for his next project, and it is. Hoover biopic.
J. Edgar Hoover, who was the first FBI director back in the early kind of 1900s. I want to go, checking into it now, but I want to go, 1920s, 1930s, and just really kind of the beginning of, obviously, because actually, if you guys have seen Public Enemies, that is the role that,
He founded it in 1935.
Okay, 1935. That's the role that, what's his name plays? Billy Crudup.
Yes, Billy Crudup.
Before the FBI, so I think when he was going after Dillinger, he was in charge of police in Chicago at least, or actually, essentially, I think it was almost like a U.S. Marshal Service, and that was like Christian Bale's character, Melvin Purvis, was his, like, you know, right-hand man and all that stuff. So, yeah, very controversial figure. You know, you have the whole cross-dressing thing. It's always been a big thing, and I guess it kind of would make sense that it would make sense that a guy, a writer like Dustin Lance Black, who is, if you just look at what he's made, writing Milk, which is obviously about Harvey Milk, yeah, who's a first elected gay official, and then even What's Wrong with Virginia, which I actually got to, I had to watch an early cut of it a couple months back. That's a movie that's very much just about sexuality and growing up, and just kind of discovering your sexuality and living with sexuality and da-da-da. So, you know, Hoover, that part of that kind of dark secret in Hoover's past, or in Hoover's personal life, will be interesting to see portrayed by the guy who wrote Milk and What's Wrong with Virginia. So I'm kind of excited. And also, Leonardo DiCaprio. I don't think he's really played a role like that in a while.
No, I mean, the last biopic was Aviator. But
yeah, no, but I mean, like, even like even in the Basketball Diaries, for example, which is actually like a little biopic, there's like a sexual kind of thing with that is in turn with the drugs, and you know, when you go back. And it's an underrated movie. When you go back and you watch Leo in that role as just a vulnerable kind of victim of drugs and, you know, what he does for drugs. You know, he does kind of deviant sexual acts that he obviously, as a heterosexual male, doesn't want to do, but he does it anyway for drugs. I mean, that's a compromising thing. You don't see movie stars in a lot. So I wonder how far they'll go with the Hoover biopic, you know, with Clint Eastwood directing, and we'll see. But
yeah,
definitely interesting. Yeah. You know, curious to see what they come up with.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's no news on when it will start shooting.
He said bangs him out quick, though.
It's expected shortly.
Yeah,
so
he gets him out there quick.
Yeah.
Grant Juno had, like a 25-day shoot or something. Yeah. Crazy. Yeah. It's a crazy thing, you know, so.
Yep.
Bangs him out.
All right, well, let's jump into news or film reviews.
Let's do it.
All right, so first review. Let's get it
best
over.
Best first. Jonah Hex. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, Jonah Hex. Let's get it out of the way.
Yeah. So Jimmy Hayward. Now he did.
Horton Hears a Who.
Which
I actually have never seen.
I have never seen either.
Are you serious?
Yes.
Wow. I thought that you'd seen it.
I thought I.
Wow. I feel bad now. Well, what do you know? Well, it was generally well received. I think one of the more moderate in every kind of single way entries into the DreamWorks, yeah. Into the DreamWorks canon of films. The Sony DreamWorks.
But then WB
or not Sony,
gave
rather.
Him
what is DreamWorks? DreamWorks and who?
And
because they're associated with someone else. But anyway.
Anyways.
They you know, not Pixar.
Yes.
Is the point. But
Paramount.
It was okay. Paramount. Jim Carrey was the voice of Horton, and Steve Carell. Or no, Horton was the elephant. Steve Carell was like the main who. You know, didn't really. It made modest money, but this dude directed Jonah Hex. Why? It's a good question.
That is a great question.
Yeah, it's a good.
This is written by Mark Neville Dean and Brian Taylor, who we talked about last week. They're doing Ghost Rider,
right?
But
Ghost Rider 2.
Ghost Rider 2. It's the Spirit of Vengeance.
The Spirit of.
Great title. And so they wrote this, and it's kind of, it's based on the DC comic.
Right.
Has a lot, kind of a solid fan base, but it's not really one of
the
popular.
Well, it's got a cult fan base, you know, just like,
popular.
Yeah, definitely.
And, so, I mean, this kind of had a lot of the right ingredients. You have Josh Brolin.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely had, what looked like a risky summer studio release, which you know, so even something along the lines of Splice, you know, like something where it's like, wow, I can't believe they're making that movie, you know, because you had like Josh Brolin playing the headline star. He's not really a movie star. I mean, he's a good actor, but you know, the only really headlining role I can think of is in W, which I mean, that was Oliver Stone's name, not Josh Brolin's name, but this is, you know, no name director, Josh Brolin as really your headliner, Megan Fox, you know, in it, but. You know, the Neville Dean Taylor news was good because these are the people who did the Crank films.
Yes.
They did Gamer. And I mean, you know, they're obviously polarizing films because they're not much by way of depth character-wise, but by way of visual, you know, ambition, they're very creative.
So what do you think of the movie? Do you think they delivered?
What's that? No, well, that's the point. Yeah, the whole point being all these ingredients are...
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it just doesn't come together.
Right? No, yeah.
You know, it just totally, it seems like Warner Brothers kind of panicked a little bit.
Well, you could tell even with that, as soon as, you know, advertising a six weeks we got the trailer.
Yeah,
six,
yeah. Six, I mean, it clearly
a lot of the insider, like, people just said Warner Brothers saw the film and just kind of
just forgot about it, wrote it off. Yeah. Yeah. So that's what, you know, Deadline said that they wrote it off. Which I mean, you know, I hate to, I mean, obviously that is hearsay because I mean, there's no source backing that up, but watching, I mean, it's a 73-minute movie or however long. I mean, it's
without.
Yeah, it's 73 minutes just without credits. And it feels long, you know. So I mean, it's one of those things where I mean, clearly there were just sections of this movie that were taken out. Like, I mean, there has to be because, well, I mean, on Film School Rejects, right? Our one of our writers, and one of Film School Rejects writers, Jack Giroux, right? It's Giroux, sorry, Jack.
He talked to Brian Taylor, and Brian Taylor gave him. He said how much he loved. The movie. So Brian Taylor gave him the script, and
did he?
Yeah.
Is that how he got the script?
Yeah. And so he talked to Brian Taylor and kind of approved him. He said, you know, you can go ahead and write this. That's fine. And so he wrote this up, and if you check, you can check it on Film School Rejects. It's kind of interesting. It's all the stuff that was, you know, cut out of the film, not even shot. I mean, just from the script that didn't make it, not just from the comics.
I know he says this in his interview now. Now Jordan, help me with this. There was a point where Neville Dean Taylor was supposed to direct this movie.
Yeah, that's what he says.
I never read that story. I always thought it was one of those things where it was like someone else was always going to direct it, and then it was like, oh, Neville Dean Taylor got hired to write it, and I was like, oh wow, that's weird. You know,
it says it's incredibly paint by numbers and not the unique piece of craziness we would have gotten if Mark Neville Dean and Brian Taylor directed as intended.
Yeah, that's what I mean, and I thought. That, I mean, you know, perhaps whoever it was, Brian Taylor or Mark Neville Dean, who told and gave Jack the screenplay, but maybe he mentioned to Jack that, you know, at least within the studio, that was the original intention. Yeah. But I mean, someone made a good point on the comments of actually Jack's article. They said why Warner Brothers thought that the dude who directed Hornies of Who would be a better fit for Jonah Hex than the guys who directed Crank is beyond me. And that is a really good question. I mean, I don't understand how. I mean, I'm obviously, you know, behind the scenes handshakes, and you know, one person knows another person. Obviously, that's how you're going to get jobs in this life, not just the film business, but any business. But so, just, I don't know. I would just like to hear how Jimmy Hayward got the job. The point.
I mean, they said WB was exploring the possibilities of Andy Fickman or McGee. So, but anyways.
We are Hex.
Yeah, so...
We are Jonah Hex.
So the film, yeah, it's...
But yeah,
it's,
back
it's,
to the film, I mean...
It's a complete mess. I mean...
I mean, yeah, I definitely, based on the 15% Rotten Tomatoes rating, I was definitely expecting worse.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, it's not... I mean, I was never bored
in
this movie.
It's not unwatchable.
I wasn't really bored.
Yeah, but see, I don't know. See, I will say that I was bored. Like, I did get... Yeah, I mean, there are scenes that... Like, that's what's weird. That is what's weird about this movie is... It's so short, but there are scenes that are kind of, they're like a little long-winded, and it's kind of strange because you're like, wow, this is, because you feel like, I don't know, it had me wondering, you know, for example, a movie like Cloverfield, which is almost the exact, I mean, Cloverfield's was like 80 minutes, 75 minutes, I mean, it's very short, but that movie literally feels like they just cut out all the fat, so you have this like 75, 80 minute piece of just kinetic, just kinetic filmmaking.
Yeah.
But this felt like, you know, 50 minutes of that, and then there was like 25 minutes of just kind of, it had me wondering why one scene was in the movie when there must have been something else shot that didn't make it. And so, I mean, obviously there's things, it's PG-13, it was originally intended to be R.
Yes.
You know, if you read Jack's, you know, little review comparison with the Neville Dean Taylor script, obviously the Neville Dean Taylor script was R, as you'd expect from the people who made, you know, the Crank movies and Gamer, which are very violent, ultra-violent movies. So, I mean, clearly the studio had something to do with that. Clearly, you know, Megan Fox, Hooker with a Heart of Gold character, got a lot more play in the final product than I guess she did in the original draft.
Yeah, the original draft. It was actually cool. She was kind of like this, like older
woman. She looked like, I guess, a hooker like that would look like. But, you know, like, truthfully, I didn't mind her in the role.
That was kind of the part I was fearing, because from the trailer, it's just kind of like, oh.
Yeah, I mean, whatever. Her accent's, you know, like, bad.
I mean,
but, like,
she plays a convincing hooker. I mean, she's a whore.
No, yeah. No, that's what I mean. I mean, yeah, like, okay, is she way too beautiful to be a hooker? Yeah, but so was the hooker in High Noon. You know what I mean? Like, you know, the original Hooker with the Heart of Gold. Like, that is the original. I mean, that is literally, that's a genre staple by now, that character. Mm-hmm. And that the I can't even know, I don't know her name, but the original woman who played the Hooker with the Heart of Gold in High Noon with Gary Cooper is gorgeous. And so, like, when you watch that movie, which is a masterpiece,
I just watched 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, when you watch that masterpiece, even then, I remember my dad saying when we watched it, I was like 13. I was like, wow, like, look how beautiful she is. So, I mean, I got past that, and she was, I thought she was fine. And, yeah.
I mean, I think Michael Fassbender was a standout.
Like the second henchman, or the henchman to John Malkovich's antagonist, the bad guy. Yeah, and he's horrible.
Really is.
I mean, it's weird. John Malkovich, like, I would equate him to, like, a Ben Kingsley, where, like this would be, like, this is Ben Kingsley in Prince of Persia.
Yeah.
You know, I even think that it's, I guess, worse. I mean, he's bad. Ben Kingsley is bad in Prince of Persia, but Malkovich is probably worse. I mean, this is... By a nose, a worse movie. Or, you know, maybe not even. I don't know.
I would say they're on the same tier. I would give them each around four. I'd say four out of ten.
Yeah, I don't know. It's tough to say which one's better.
Yeah.
Prince of Persia or Joan X. But,
No, Will Arnett's kind of odd. Really, really odd.
Yeah,
bad
casting. You know, like, I hate to hate on the Will Arnett. Because, I mean, I think he probably really tried hard. But, it's just strange, you know, to see Job. Just playing it completely serious is very weird.
Yeah. Then our main star, Josh Brolin, I think he did a fine job, but he could have...
I was surprised he didn't do a better job.
Yeah.
You know, I definitely was surprised. I mean, I liked the makeup for his face. I thought was really good. And I dug that. But, like, I was surprised. Yeah, I don't know why. I don't know. Because he is, like... You know, when he played, for example, in W, his other lead performance, I mean, you know... Say what you will about the movie, very flawed, but his performance is, I thought, a revelation. I mean, there were so many things going on. I mean, there were so many interesting angles to, like, his portrayal of our 43rd president, and it literally just gave you a lot to think about just the person, you know, and the caricature. And then in Milk, the same kind of thing. And then he's playing a fictional character, and it feels like he's playing it too close to the note. You know, it's weird. Like, he plays these real-life characters with this, like, creativity and this fervor, and then he's playing this guy who you could think you could do whatever the fuck you wanted because he's, like, this crazy DC Comics character, and he kind of plays it safe, it seems like, which is strange because we read all those news reports about, articles about how this is, like, a very big passion project for him. And so, I don't know what happened. You know, maybe he got caught up in something else or something. very surprised.
I mean, and then some moments I liked. I mean, just want to quickly
talk about. Go for it.
There's a train sequence early on, which actually has some beautiful cinematography in it. Like, there's the camera. There's a couple shots where the camera's panning across, tracking across the train, and there's one shot which I really loved it's on the track with the camera, or it's on the track of the train, and the train's coming at it, and the camera, like, flies back with a steam coming up right in the middle.
Oh, yeah, that was nice.
I really liked that shot. That nice. And Michael Fassbender in that scene was kind of funny, like, he's whistling as he was going to blow up.
Yeah, that was a good.
And then, like, the way they like, take over the train to steal the dynamite, and, like, they wear those, like, masks that you see in every horror movie now, and, like, pulling down, and I just like the way that was put together, and then there was, like, moments of, like, things that like were awesome, like spoilers coming up. Michael Fassbender dies, and the way he dies is kind of awesome.
It is.
And then another touch, the dynamite gun. It should have been a lot cooler because it's a dynamite crossbow gun. But
that was cool, though. But it was cool. I mean, that was cool. He just literally blows 25 people away.
Yeah.
Sorry, keep going with what you liked about it. Go ahead.
The one scene which I thought they should have done more with is the creepy cage match with Michael Shannon in it for 3 seconds.
Yes, as the ring
like I was because like I didn't expect that because I know and also as Jackson in their review there's like zombies in this movie that he like in the original script and stuff and like stuff like that would have been cool because there's this like fantastical element where he can bring dead people back to life and that idea itself is cool but the way it's handled is kind of.
I mean, I thought there were some cool aspects to it. I mean, he doesn't bring them back to life, but he summons them so they're alive to him, you know.
Yeah.
But what's cool is as soon as he starts doing it and he lifts them up from the ground, they start burning.
Yeah. The sooner they're dead, the quicker they burn.
Yeah. And so, I mean, it's pretty interesting. The way they do that, you know what I mean? Jeffrey Dean Morgan plays
Jeb
Turnbull, who is John Malkovich's son, which is very strange casting, and also Joan Hex's ex-best friend, and through, they're fighting the Civil War together, and this is how the whole thing started, Joan Hex he disobeyed a direct order from John Malkovich's character to, like, I guess, slaughter a village or something, whatever, burn a church down or something, you know, what always happens, you know, Mel Gibson, the Patriot style. And he turned it down. He ended up killing, you know, in turning him down, he ended up having to kill his best friend Jeb, who's Jeffrey Dean Morgan. And then Quinn Turnbull kills Jonah Hex's family, and that causes the revenge to get Turnbull, blah, 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 blah.
Which you will know by the end about 10 times.
Right, they, like, and that's the other thing that's so weird about it being 74 minutes long is that
10 minutes are flashback.
10 minutes is, like, pounding it back in your head, like, literally recalling shots, or it's like, I do you remember that he got his family got burned.
I think his face got scarred, right? Did you get that? Okay.
It was just, like, one of those things, very strange, like, oh, I don't know why that survived. Clearly, the Warner Brothers thinks that, or Jimmy Hayward, or whoever the editor thinks that the people who are watching this were just, like, hick retards.
And very over-edited. At the beginning, there's, like, shots that, like, that look like long, nice kind of dragon shots. There's one on the coffin that comes back later. Yeah. And, like, they cut, like, I don't know if they didn't have the shot, but they cut, like, three times in that one long tracking shot to, like, it was really odd. I just noticed that in the beginning. Yeah, towards the end, it gets better, but, like, and then there's that 10-minute, or not 10, 5-minute, like, animation that is just...
Oh,
like,
yeah, that was rough. I really hated that. That was kind of rough.
It looked like I could have done that in Flash. Like, I wasn't cool. Like,
I don't know. It wasn't that good. Yeah. I mean, I don't usually mind...
Yeah. Well, Kick-Ass did it really...
Did Kick-Ass do it?
What the Nicolas Cage backstory is all done in comic form.
That's right.
And that worked.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, like, I guess I don't mind because as, like, an homage to, like, the medium. I don't mind that. I mean, even and this is funny, like, even in Ang Lee's The Hulk, which people had a big problem with the way he did that, where, like, there was literally comic strips and stuff. I actually did not mind that in the film as a thing, as like a little style thing. Yeah. I mean, I just minded it because it was so poorly made. Yeah. But I mean, and actually, I'm just saying, so, but this, yes, just because it felt... The animation itself felt poorly.
They're like, "Oh shit, we didn't shoot any of this.
It felt like that.
We didn't have the budget.
Like they did it 4 months ago. Like they did it 4 months ago. So, I mean,
and then one really we aren't in spoilers, I guess.
Yeah.
The weapon that they're going after, it was kind of stupidly designed. I thought, like,
for sure.
Like they shoot six balls out, and then they have one ball. Like, why can't you? Just I didn't have really the
get
it.
I didn't get why.
Well, here's the thing: like, if you haven't seen the movie, which you probably haven't, because I don't think anyone saw it.
No.
There's this weapon that's, like, kind of the MacGuffin-ish, but they use it later, so I don't know if it... But anyways...
Yeah, it's the thing that everyone wants.
Yeah, and it's a rotating cannon with six barrels, this massive... Yeah, and they shoot these... They look just like cannonballs.
They shoot, like, essentially cannons that are mines.
Yeah.
And then there's an orange ball that's the last one, of course, that shoots out, and it's, like, the one that blows up and triggers all of them. But it just begs the question... Obviously.
And the reason that they couldn't complete their goal in the final mission is because they couldn't shoot out the orange ball, not because they got... So if they had...
Right, they
that
shot out all the other cannonballs before. Yeah. And it's one of those things where you watch, you're just kind of like, well, why wouldn't you just make one... Like, because then that's the other thing that's, like, it just... Why wouldn't you just make, like, six orange balls?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, instead of... Because then it'd be like... Because the other thing is, like, clearly the orange... It's not one of these things where, like, the orange ball is, like, the chemicals and everything else has the detonation capability. Because it's like, the orange ball goes off and explodes, and then it, like, connects with all the other ones like you would in a mine.
I thought it was more like it made those others blow up. So it was kind of dinner, but you know what I mean? Like,
but I'm saying that the orange ball itself blows up.
Right.
Because if you remember, that's how John Malkovich dies.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
So the point is, if the orange ball itself blows up, then why not make six of them so you could just, like, launch, and it would just be, like, and it would be literally, like, rocket launchers. You know what I mean? Like, so, even if Malkovich ultimately loses, they could have killed, you know, 5,000 of, like, the black people who were at the thing, which was another horrible... That was a horrible subplot.
Yeah,
the guy
from
The
Wire.
I hated that. The dude from The Wire played Smith, who I assume... I haven't read the graphic novels or the comics. I assume was a very cool character in the comics. He's, like, this weapons manufacturer who Josh Brolin knows, and he gets his Gatling guns, which, by the way, are in one scene in the movie, which I didn't mind.
Yeah.
I liked that.
Talking about the humor in the movie, because a lot of people thought it was just... There was
humorless.
No humor.
I laughed.
Yeah, I
definitely laughed. Yeah, I mean, I thought there were moments that were very well written, you know, like, there's some really nice one-liners. Yeah. I guess some people say that, like, Jonah Hex isn't a one-liner character, but, I mean, I'll say that I think that that's stupid. Having watched the movie, I think that he should have been. I mean, I don't know. He's a cowboy with a scarred face. Yeah. He should have one-liners. Yeah. It just kind of... But But no, I mean, I think at, in the end, it's just a very messy, tame movie that has moments of kind of odd, intriguing, you know, kind of splendor, you know, and you're just kind of like, oh, and then it's not there anymore, and then that's it. But just quickly, what I was going to, just to qualify myself,
yes.
There's this, with the Smith character from The Wire, he's this black guy, and obviously it's like back in the day, and they just have been awarded their freedom, da-da-da, all that stuff, and it's like this weird emotional pull they try to do where it's like he's with his sons and they're listening to President Grant, played by Aidan Quinn, which is very strange, it's the 100th year celebration of America, and it's like wow, these balls are shooting off because Malkovich's character is trying to destroy the Capitol.
Yeah.
These like all these black people have gathered together to like celebrate their freedom, and also like the, and it's just stupid because it's like we don't care about anybody in this movie, we don't care about John Hex or Megan Fox. Why would we care about this black guy, you know, who got one scene in this movie? You know what I mean? It's very strange. I don't know if that wasn't in Jack's article. I don't know if Neville Dean Taylor had like a whole subplot about that. That would have been very interesting. Yeah. You know, obviously that actor is very capable, but
The one thing I really like loved about this movie that was never fully explored, obviously, like a lot of things, was kind of the setting, like this Civil War, you know, and the like the Washington Monument was just being built, and like you never kind of see that, like you never see movies.
They were cool. And this is funny because when I saw the trailers, the first movie that came to my mind obviously was Wild Wild West, which is another just. I mean, far worse in every way disaster, just because it cost more and it was far worse and da da da. But it was similar and like it was an interesting idea because it's like, oh wow, you're making a movie that's like, you know, it's like a Western, but it's an American Western, but it's not like a lot of Westerns where it takes place kind of in the land that time forgot.
Yeah,
where it's like, you know, it's like, oh, you know, like literally, it's just like it could be in 1820, it could be in 1880. You know, but this movie, I mean, just like Wild West, is very much just at a specific time in history, and it does suck, just like in that other film, that they don't do more creatively, or just do more research.
I mean, more of his, like, Civil War backstory would have been awesome.
Yeah.
It's just
the reenactments, you know, and as Jack rightfully mentioned in his review, the Civil War reenactment, I think there's only one, is horrible.
Yeah.
It's just all bad.
Yeah, if they kind of amped up, like, those supernatural things and started kind of
serious. I guess you could argue they needed more money, maybe, because apparently it only cost $35 million, or $40 million. Yeah. But
it doesn't feel, that's weird, because it doesn't feel like a cheap movie, but it feels like someone
it does, cut though. Out the... I don't know, it's a very B movie in terms of that,
but I don't like some of the like production design and set, like it could have been great, like kind of like feel it, but it's not like all
it
there.
Just seems know. Oh man, just like it's just a shame. I mean, I don't know, I, you know, I'll be honest, of movies to fuck up, I'm not going to lose sleep over John Hex. I mean, I don't think, you know, I like Neville Dean Taylor. I've liked all three of their films, Crank, The Two Cranks, and Gamer. I have them.
Yeah.
But even if they had directed it, even if they had gotten a higher rating, even if they had gotten $20 million more, you know, even if Megan Fox became an amazing actress and, like, Malkovich learned how to actually have an accent or something, like, even all that stuff, it still would have just been, you know, a Crank-like, ridiculous thing in the West, which I don't really think we need right now in the world. So, like, I don't think that it would have been a big loss, or it would have been a big feat anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
But that said, obviously it does make you curious as to what it could have been, you know. Yeah. So I mean, I think Josh Brolin, you know, whether he did it to himself or whether he got kind of bullied by Warners and Jimmy Hayward or what have you, he deserves a better platform film.
Yeah.
And hopefully he'll kind of regain some of his rep with, like, Wall Street 2 coming out. And even though I've heard he's in the You and Me, a Tall, Dark Stranger, which got panned at Cannes.
He has actually 4 movies coming out this year, which is kind of crazy.
So apparently the Woody Allen movie, Jonah Hex, are the two to miss. And then True Grit and Wall Street 2 are the two to wait for.
And then we got MIB 3.
Is he in that? Oh my god! Oh yeah, he plays the young. He's like the main character, isn't he?
Tommy Lee Jones.
Because apparently Tommy Lee Jones isn't in it that much. Apparently, yeah. It's like Will Smith goes back. Yeah. Oh god, I cannot. Oh my god, I am so not excited for that movie. it is literally amazing how not. Oh. Well, like how bad? Just quickly, how bad was MIB2? Like, do you remember seeing?
Yeah,
it?
Yeah, but I was,
really,
but I don't. I can't say.
Oh,
if
oh
I,
man,
I remember loving MIB1. And
no,
I remember
MIB1
and
too.
I remember
I
not
the
as
first
loving
one.
As much. But
oh,
I
dude,
I was
I remember yeah. I remember just literally like I remember I think I saw the drive and I remember just literally my mouth being open because I just was like because that was another movie. It's like 85 minutes long. It's yeah. It kind of like Jonah Hex, and you're just watching it and you're like, how. Did all of these talented people just, like, decide that this was the best avenue to go? Like, to just do this. Like, this was a good idea. Ah, anyway.
Yeah, that was wow, it'll be 8 years. Jeez. Or it'll be 9 years.
Oh, my God. That movie was so bad. Anyway. Right. So, hey, let's talk about a better movie.
Yes.
And that better movie is
Toy Story 3. Now, we both grew up, right? Toy Story, I think
yeah,
that was one of the first
yeah,
movies.
Yeah,
we both
VHS copy somewhere, yeah, somewhere in my house. Yeah.
I mean, I had the Game Boy game. I had the
yeah,
Boys.
Yeah, dude, I
had
the
first Game Boy game
I
ever got.
I had the N64 game.
You did, nice.
Dude,
okay.
I don't know if I beat that game. I never really was good at beating video games, but I played it.
Yeah,
that
was
game.
The very first one. You were Woody
wow.
jumping out of the boxes. And
wow,
yeah.
Dude. In the Toy Story, in the N64 game, you were Buzz.
Not
still.
Yeah, and so... Yeah, 1995, I think that was.
Yes,
and 95. Then, and then Toy Story 2 a little later, which didn't have much of an impact on me. Like, I remember, I rewatched Toy Story a lot, but I just recently watched
True.
Toy Story
yeah,
2.
Yeah, I definitely agree. But I remember loving Toy Story 2.
Yeah, so. I love it. I watched it and I love it.
Yeah.
And yeah, and now we're back. Lee Unkrich.
Lee Unkrich, who.
He was an editor, which is kind of funny. Editor turned director.
Yeah. But I mean, if you talk to anyone that knows anything about the Pixar movies, they'll tell you that really the way that the credits go, apparently, it's very like. It's very just kind of like, you know, whose turn is it this time?
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, which, I mean, hey, that could be hearsay. I don't know. Obviously, I don't know. But, I mean, you know, like, Andrew Stanton directed my two favorites. So, like, did he? You know what I mean? I like to think so.
But
you know what I mean? So, that's kind of one of those things. But, anyway, definitely Lee Unkrich was worthy, whatever. He was a worthy person to get the director title because this is a really... reminded you, Jordan, of the first two movies and just what it's like to be young and then also what it's like to be growing up and whirlwind of emotions.
Oh, yeah,
sure.
Completely. And, I mean, before, I was thinking about the other Pixar films and I think this one is the most wholly satisfying one.
Really?
Because I love, before this, WALL-E was my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
And I love, I mean, the first 40 minutes of WALL-E, and I'm not the one of the person that thinks, oh, it drops off and it's terrible the last half.
But I mean, understandably, it becomes less
great
of a film. Yeah,
yeah.
Sure.
And up on rewatching, first 20 minutes I love, and the rest is
good. It definitely, good. That it's, definitely, yeah, has a, see, the movie that holds the most weight still to this day for me, and is a movie that I could literally watch right now, in 2 hours from now, even if we just watch it right now, I can watch it again in 2 hours. Finding Nemo. I love Finding Nemo.
That
Finding
is one
Nemo
that probably is
the same. Probably, just in terms of just every aspect of a favorite movie, where it's like, you know, personal, like, oh, what's your personal, you know, Finding Nemo probably for Pixar is fucking.
And I mean compared to the first two films,
yeah.
Toy Story, I mean, it introduces us to these great characters, a great adventure, but like that emotion that, and it's there, but it's not, in this movie, it's like, full on.
But it can be argued, and I believe this, that without the first one,
right, exactly.
The emotion obviously
wouldn't be here in the
third, because this is a very nostalgic, very, almost like a retrospective in a way.
Yeah.
Almost like, at some point, it's like a greatest hits kind of thing, which I'm not, that's not a mean thing, obviously that is a criticism, but it doesn't have to be a bad criticism. I mean, they do it really well. It opens with another kind of imaginative scene from Andy's mind, which is really fun. Probably the best one I think they've done, of those.
Well, I love how they just did it, because in Toy Story 2 it was a sci-fi with Buzz, now here is like a Western with, and you bring in like all the characters.
This was like literally like an all-encompassing thing, like this movie is.
Yeah.
And then it cuts out and it's a video of when Andy was younger, and obviously, you know, as someone who grew up, you know, with the first movie, that's like, you're like, oh my god, like, there, you know, I remember that. And then, so I mean, obviously that's it, it initially it does feel a little cheap because you're like, oh, okay, you're gonna like play off our emotions. But I mean, it's a sequel. It's a second sequel, so I think definitely it reintroduces us to the characters, reestablishes, you know, why we love them in the first place. I think it was very smart. And then you have just a lot of little nice little like little, you know, tidbits that remind us, you know, for example, you know, they mentioned Bo Peep at one point. Yeah. And you're just, you know, very sad. You're like, oh, Bo Peep, like I remember from, you know, the first two films. Mm-hmm. And there's a really great joke with the dog.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, dog, so they're yeah. those, so these reflective jokes, though, obviously they wouldn't live without the first two movies, carry on their own kind yeah. of
I mean, that's way, the thing with, you know, like a lot of people have said, you know, oh my God, it's been 10 years. Like, are they, I mean, are we going to care about these characters again? And like, I think if this movie came out in 2004, 2005, it wouldn't have the same impact. I don't, like,
yeah, I mean, I wonder.
Because back then, you know, I was just leaving high school and that. I don't know. In terms of our age
group. Well, for us.
For us, yeah, yeah. But I mean, for everyone else, I don't know.
I mean,
but,
you know, like for me, you know, for me and you, I think a big part, I mean, this movie affected me, you know, because we just graduated college and now it's, you know, we're literally moving on to, you know, probably the biggest separated step of our lives, where it's literally school for 21 years, 22 yeah. years, and then something else. So yeah. then when you watch something like Toy Story 3, where it just, I mean, even though obviously, and we'll talk about this later,
yeah.
there might be a future for these characters. This very much feels like, you know, some sort of a bookended thing. Oh, so yeah. you watch it, and it does feel like the end of an era,
yeah.
An era, and
I mean, even the, shot, the shots, exactly the clouds. That's the hell.
Right at the end, right yeah. the clouds. Okay, yeah, obviously. Like, but so, I mean, stuff like that is just very for our age group. Who I think we were probably around. I mean, the age group that really hit Toy Story hit first. I mean, we were 8 when Toy yeah. Story came out. You know, so but it was funny. We were watching. I watched the trailer. On Rotten Tomatoes, you know, they just went down all the Pixar movies. And I cannot believe this is only the 11th Pixar movie. It feels like they've taken over the world with so much more than that. But
yes.
But I watched the Rotten Tomatoes put up the teaser for the first Toy Story movie. And I watched it. And it just, like, literally just reminds you of how great that first movie is. Just, there's so many scenes in that first movie that are just so, like, iconic.
Yeah.
And I do wonder if this film will have the same... shelf life, you know. I don't know, what do you think? Like, obviously, films like Bug's Life and Cars, and you know, I'm trying to think. Even Monsters Inc.
Yeah.
don't have. I mean, they're loved by men. Yeah. You know, Cars is loved by a lot of people. Obviously, that aren't our age. Yeah. You know, kids should probably react to Cars the way we reacted to Toy Story, but they don't have the same.
Yeah. I mean, I think like you said, the third movie comes with the first two. It's not like, and I think as a trilogy, it is. I can't think of a better trilogy. I was trying to think. Like,
but yeah, that's a good point.
Like,
is there a better trilogy?
I don't know. Each movie, like, both they each stand on their own.
The Die Hard show?
No, they're really. I mean, Star Trek. I mean, Star Wars. Sorry, Star Wars.
Star Wars. Wars is. I mean, I would say on a similar level of, you know, it's very much an entertainment thing. Mm-hmm.
Return of the Jedi. And throw,
I guess this is definitely a more satisfying. Second
Godfather,
sequel.
No, I'm trying to think, you know.
Well, the third, yeah, the third one, yeah. That's interesting. That's an interesting point.
Yeah, I mean,
the Bourne trilogy.
Is no, but I never. I mean, the emotion that Toy Story 3 get out of me is.
Like comparing oil and water, but I mean, but still, I mean, the Bourne trilogy is fucking good.
It is.
But yeah. I guess this is probably the best trilogy. Yeah, it's an interesting point.
And and in terms of like the new characters, if you want to talk about that for a little bit, the
did it perfectly. I thought.
Yeah. Because you know, a lot of these threes, you know, Spider-Man and stuff, and other three
paths
are just. Yeah,
I mean, even Iron Man 2.
Yeah, Iron Man 2.
Batman and Robin.
And with this, each character has like. I mean, some moments are small, but they each have like just something that's so memorable. Like if you name a character, I can immediately come up with what they did and what I loved about them, and handled so well. Some highlights, if you want to go, like Mr. Prickle Pants.
Love it,
and he's
absolutely love it. Like a Kenneth Branagh spoof in a Richard like the Lionheart esque toy, you know, like voiced by the perfect dude to spoof. Kenneth Branagh, Timothy Dalton,
yeah.
you know, who spoofed a Brit himself in Hot Fuzz. You know, so literally you can tell they did the research, you know, Pixar, obviously, then, with the voice decisions there.
And then the FBI informant, like, phone, like, the old school.
Oh, God, so funny. I forgot about him. I can't remember who did that voice, but he look it up. He's good.
And, I mean, Ken was a big guy. He was one of the bigger new characters. Ken,
yes, Michael Keaton, yeah.
And, yeah, and I mean, there's so many. I mean, what do you think now? The villain, I guess, spoilers coming up.
Yeah, spoilers. You know, obviously,
I think everyone totally
recommends seeing it.
Yeah, absolutely,
you
see it.
If you're listening, you probably saw it already, but totally see it. I mean, especially if the first two Toy Stories were a part of your life, or if you have kids, or you have nieces, nephews, or brothers and sisters who have not been exposed to it yet. This is definitely worth, you know, taking them to go see.
And even if it wasn't part of your life, I know I actually...
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
A few people that, I mean, I know haven't even seen the first two. I mean, I would just say get those first two, watch them, and then watch this. It's like a perfect...
Yeah. Trilogy. Oh, just a good... could be a great weekend for you.
And yeah, so the villain,
Lotso.
Yeah. Lotso Huggin Bear.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, a lot of people have said that... he was kind of like the prospector in the second. He's kind of like this nice, really older, friendly,
like a nice,
and then he kind of turns at the end. And I mean,
which is true,
yeah.
But obviously, the big difference is, and I'm pretty sure this is true, the prospector didn't have really much of a backstory,
yeah.
And Lotso has. I mean, a big part. I mean, his character is his backstory, which is, you know, he was once the most loved toy of this girl, Pearl, and one day, their family went on a picnic, and the parents forgot the toys, like, on the blanket, and they had to, like, walk, and, you know, so the toys obviously made this huge journey back to the house, and by the time they got back, Pearl had already bought, her parents had bought Pearl a new Lotso.
You know what?
And you, Jordan, were saying you didn't like it that much. That was one of your least favorite parts of the movie.
Yeah, I don't know, something about that, like... I just feel like that theme is already, like, it wasn't surprising that, like, he would.
Yeah, and I agree. It's not surprising. Yeah. It's very
One
easy.
One thing I thought would have been awesome would be to kind of get the feeling that, like, these toys have such a long life, is they, that journey that they took, they came back, and it was the daughter of the girl they grew up with. Like, that would have been mind-blowing to feel. Because, like, the movie has this, like, kind of thing where, like, in the beginning they talk about this attic, and it's like, we're going to go up there, kind of like this, like, heaven. Well, first they paint Sunnyside as this, like, heaven area.
Right, of course.
And then they paint this attic. And first they said, like, well, like, our goal is to go to the attic and kind of live there forever, and, like, we'll have board games and stuff. And it's kind of, like, the sad thing that, like, we'll be with our friends, but which this film explores, so we can talk about that later, the friendship thing. But, like, but they're going to go up to Annie's attic and just these, what, 10 toys probably by now, we'll just live together forever.
Yeah.
And, like, and what I would have loved to see kind of to even expand on that would be to have that Lotso character make this huge journey and have, I mean, I don't know how far away they went for a picnic, but which is kind
well,
of
but still.
But to have it, like, be like, oh, wow, there's a whole nother generation, and, like,
in a reverse way, I did like that they did this was, mm-hmm. Like you're saying, it's about friends, but, and obviously these are just toys, but what's nice about it is just, I mean, you know, it puts it in perspective, obviously, that, you know, how we as humans, you know, treat things, but also, if you want to kind of get down to the toys level and use them as metaphors for friendship, which the movie also does, it also puts into perspective what it means to be, like, a good friend, right? And so you have, for example, Lotso, he gets back, and he's been replaced. And it's for a moment, it's eye-opening for me, at least, because it's, like, it reminds you, it's like, wow, these are just toys, you know, and you can just literally buy a new one. And, like, that's sad that if in real life, like, they had feelings, isn't it so sad that we as people just kind of regard them as just tools, you know.
Yeah.
But on another end, Lotso, if you get down to his level, it would be, you know, like a betrayal of a friend, you know, to go so far out of your way to do something good for a friend, to get back to a friend or something, and then to have it be to just be blindsided like that. So you have another end of the spectrum, whereas obviously with the toys, the main toys, you know, the Woody and the Buzz toys, they kind of, they, you know, will forever represent the, you know, solidarity of friendship. So just lots of kind of plays the other side of the card. So I thought that really worked well because it kind of does remind you that there is a darker side to Oz kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. So I mean, I think it worked. It was definitely easy, and that your idea of longevity would have been interesting. I thought of that too when I was watching. I just thought of, like, you know, like, wow, like, you know, Woody, you know, how long is Woody going to be played with
for
the rest of his, you know, is Woody just going to be this, you know, like, crappy toy, you know, in, like, 50 years? That, you know, it's just very interesting.
Just talking about Lotso, what do you think about his, I mean, towards the end, this can lead us to the friendship thing, but the toys are in this trash, they go to this trash, or garbage, landfill, and they're kind of on this, like, track to their doom.
To their doom.
Fire. And Lotso, Woody saves Lotso from dying or getting cut up, and then Lotso goes to almost save them, and then he turns back. And
yeah, well, it's like Woody saves Lotso, and then Lotso climbs up a ladder to save all of them by stopping the conveyor belt by pressing a button. So he gets up to the button, and then he looks at Woody and all them, and he doesn't press it.
Yeah.
And it's like,
I mean, because one reviewer that didn't like it said this movie is, like, just kind of mean and, like, sad, like, in terms of that.
Yeah.
And Woody, I mean, did you, I like, thinking back at that, like, that, there's no moment of redemption on that, like, you know what I mean? With,
well,
like, I mean,
Lotso dies, though.
That's true. Well, he's on the front of the car forever.
Oh, true. Okay,
he doesn't die. So he doesn't even die, and it's like, I don't know, like that moment was so mean, and, like, you kind of feel like there would be a moment.
Yeah, but see, like, I like that, because this movie does have this, like, such, like I was saying before, it's got a dark edge. Like, of course Lotso would betray these friends of his, because, like, he got betrayed.
Yeah.
And he's like this lower class of toy, you know, just, like, there are lower classes of people that, you know, literally, like, what does friendship mean to you?
Yeah.
You know, like, obviously, there's a code, you know, like, you know, if Woody is going to save your life, obviously you're going to stop the conveyor belt, because that is the way that it works. That's the way that life works. And Lotso doesn't live by that code because, you know, Pearl or her parents or whatever didn't live by that code. So, I mean, but it's definitely meaner than the first two.
Then it led to that scene, which it's like one of the best scenes so if you haven't seen it, I don't know why you're still listening, but we can talk about it. These toys, Lotso doesn't push the button. They get thrown into this.
Right, to get burned up.
It's kind of just
in an inferno, essentially.
And so beautifully animated, like with the fire. Oh my god, it's just so, this whole movie is just so visually impressive. We can talk about that.
Wait, but how did they end up not dying again?
The claw.
Oh god, I love that. No, but for this moment,
I think everyone in theater was like,
For about a minute.
It's a really extended scene where, you know, slowly Jesse holds Buzz's hand, the potato heads hold it.
I told you what I thought. I thought that Woody wasn't going to hold their hands, which I don't know why I thought that.
He already kind of does it.
But see, doesn't it show how invested you are just, like, with the characters that, like, I literally thought, like, I was like, well, Woody would, you know, like, Woody's going to save him. Yeah. Like, that's literally, like, what I was thinking in my head.
Like, just think about it. Like, these are all animated by Pixels, it's unreal how much Pixar can make this feel. And so slowly, like, these toys, they start holding hands, and, like,
when Woody finally holds Buzz's hand, then it's like,
the look on his face.
And, like, literally everybody in the theater, like, I was just like, oh, fuck. You know, because, like, Woody's the last, you know, he's, like, the last.
And, like, I mean, my heart was, like oh, boom, boom,
God,
boom.
Dude, that was so sad.
And it just gives a sense, like, these toys, like, even wherever they go, they, like, our best friends. And, like, it even in your own life, like, just thinking about friendship, I was like,
I know. I know. It really was affecting.
And then the claw comes down, and it's a nice throwback even to the early thing. Like, I've never was like,
oh my god.
And from that, I mean, from that moment on, the movie is just, like, brilliant, like the whole ending sequence.
It's good. Yeah,
talk about that. So they go, they escape the landfill. They go back home, and in another like this movie is just like the last three scenes are just like so
just heart-wrenching.
And one scene that I love it. One of the first times Toy Story has ever kind of had human only interaction. You know what I mean? Like only human, like Andy and his mom. Is she's finally saying goodbye, and it just, like, hit me, like, you know, we're going, like, we're out of college now, and it's, like, you know, after this moment, like, Andy, you're never the same with your family, I feel like, after you leave college, like, you know what I mean? Like, you're still in my
house. Well, he's going to college.
That's what I mean, sorry. After you go to college, and it's just, like, we've seen him kind of grow up, like, for these 18 years,
I mean, it's definitely, and then you have this, you know, at the end, he, oh god, like at the end, just the scene that really got me is at the end of the movie, they all make it back into the box for the attic. And then, but then what Woody does, of course, is he writes an address like on the top of the box. And so Andy decides to take the box to this address, which is of this other girl, Bonnie, who's introduced earlier. Who's this like girl who's like really good with her toys.
It was odd that I was like, why are they like, when that scene happened, when we introduced her, I was wondering why they spent so much time with her. And then I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah, that was, that, yeah.
It was kind of an odd scene in the beginning.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And no, and then and then Andy brings toys. And Woody ends up, because Woody's the only toy that Andy's going to bring to college, Woody ends up deciding to go to like sneak into the Bonnie box, and then Andy's giving her all the toys, and then Bonnie like sees Woody who she's previously met, and like, and then grabs him, and like Andy doesn't want to let go of him. And that scene, that like that moment where this kid kind of has to realize that like he's got to let go of even like Woody, who's obviously been around like since the very beginning, that's very sad. And then like he lets go, but like not before he plays one more time. Yeah.
I mean, the whole movie is about like, is Andy ever gonna play with us again? And then at the end, totally like just
satisfaction.
Yeah,
one more time.
Yeah, and yeah, you just get this moment of like Bonnie and Andy just playing with his toys for the final time, and it really is like a satisfying ending. Like
I mean, it definitely just like you said. I mean, it puts a lot of things in perspective. I mean, we were only at that point of going to college 4 years ago, and it kind of just you're right. It reminded me of just that separation. You know, be it toys, be it anything. You know, just be it home. Be it just those things, like be it the family room, you know what I mean? I think like for me, like one of the big things about leaving, it sounds stupid, but like one of the big things about leaving home for me was like just the comfortability that you have with just things in your house. You know, the couches and the family room, just the way that looked and all that stuff, and then you lose that. So everybody has something like that. And then to have him one more time go back and just like recall it before going back, you know, before going to school and starting a whole new frontier of life, like, I mean, just really affecting, you know, and I think it's very universal. And
yeah, I mean, it's one of the most, like, genuine, just, like, anyone gets to feel, go through this movie and just get something amazing
out. Yeah, and I mean, I can't imagine, and see, movies like this always make me think, how would I react, like, how, like, when I, like, assuming I watch this movie 10 years from now, how am I going to just react to the problems, because, like, the subject matter is universal. Yeah. So, for example, you know, I'm graduating college now, so obviously when I see, like, the separation and this moving on, I relate it directly to this change in my life. But 10 years from now, is it going to be, you know, what is it going to be? You know, I'm saying that it's going to be something.
And that's the point.
Like, you know, you could be 75 and it could be about, you know, dying. You know, it could be about literally how, you know, you have to kind of just, you know, before you go back and find those things in your life that made it worth it, and you know, and all that stuff. And I think that at any point in your life that you could have that. So I think that's just something you don't see in movies a lot. Yeah. Not just, I mean, animated movies. I mean, something you just don't see in movies a lot. So I think that kind
of... And even if none of that, like, let's say none of that relates to, there's still this thrilling kind of escape plot that harkens back to, like,
of course,
every great escape movie.
I was going to say, I was surprised, and maybe I just haven't watched the first two Toy Stories in a long time, but I felt like the film references in this movie were just abundant. And I'm not saying that's bad.
There's a lot.
I'm sure there's a ton.
Jurassic Park 1 and Toy Story 2 when he's like...
Yeah, true.
But you're right.
I mean, there's from the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari to The Great Escape, you know, there's just 1,000, you know, things, you know. But, a very blatant one is The Bridge on the River Kwai with Potato Head. He gets boxed in the sand, or actually it's like it's not a sandbox, it's a litter box.
Well, I think it's a sandbox, but there's like children are poop. Yeah, it's definitely a sandbox, because there's no litter, there's no like animals. So like it's a sandbox, but they poop, there's like poop.
That's a gross sandbox.
Yeah. No, I know, that's the thing. That's the whole
you had to clean that sandbox.
The caterpillars.
Oh my God.
Yeah. The Lincoln Logs. But like, because of the children in the cabin.
And
the movie's hilarious. Like, there's, I mean,
there's a lot of
everything.
Ken, you know, the whole, I mean, obviously a very easy joke, but a funny joke, you know, the whole, the ambiguous sexuality of Ken.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, obviously Ken, the doll, doesn't have a penis, and that's why the big thing. So, like, in the movie, he's gay, but he's gay, he's not really gay. I mean, he's, you know, so it's like, that's very, very, I think, well done, because they don't, it's not really exploitive, you know, it's not exploitative, they're not. Like, oh, he's a fag. You know, it's kind of like, oh, he's like a metrosexual. Yeah. Or is he homosexual? You know, that's funny. It's funny. And
a few visual moments. Like, because a lot of this movie, obviously, because there's toys, there's a lot of close-ups of just them interacting and stuff. But then there's these moments like where they pull back for a wide shot, and, like, everything's, like, lit and animated so beautiful. Like, one of the there's a shot where, like, Buzz is approaching a vending machine. And, like, I just thought that, like, struck me the way it was lit. And there's a shot where Woody is at Bonnie's house, and, like, they're sleeping, and he has to get up and walk across the bed, and it kind of pulls back, and you see, like, the whole room, and even the kind of, like, video game-esque, like, shots of Sunnyside, like, where they're entering the room, and, like, the camera's, like, panning around, and it's just, like wow. And then one of the other things that they didn't do in Toy Story at all was the slow-motion shots. Like, there's one where Andy is getting played with genuinely for the first time with Bonnie, and, like, Woody. And, like, she throws him up in the air, and he kind of, like, flies in slow motion. Mm-hmm. And, like, and you kind of get this moment where he's, like he finally happy. Gets happy. Yeah. And then there's, just, like, a kind of a funny slow motion shot with Ken, like, at the dress-up, and he, like, the camera, when he, like, at the very last thing he dresses up with.
Yeah,
him,
yeah.
And, like, the camera kind of flashes, and he has, like, the cowboy, like, twirl things on.
I mean,
and there's just, like, little, like, touches that you don't see in any of the anime.
You know
what's
weird? Buzz doesn't do any, like, flying feats or anything in this one.
Yeah. He does the he gets up into that, the room's locked, and he gets up into the, he goes across the line, and he gets up into above the window thing.
Right,
but it's not like,
I don't know. I always from the first two movies, it just seems like they're these, like, impossible feats. Well, obviously the famous one from the first one. Didn't Toy Story 2 is a lot more Buzz based because the whole father thing,
the whole Zurich thing. Yeah. And there's a crazy feat, the one where he has to rush because they're leaving. Because I just watched it. Al's Toy Barn. Al is leaving with all the toys, and he has to get to the door, and, like, he jumps. He, like, has to make his way, like, all the way up top to the thing. Anyway, it's just this huge, like, action
feat. But doesn't it say something about this third movie that doesn't have anything like that, but it's still just as satisfying? I don't know.
Yeah.
Kind of interesting. Maybe.
It's more like a team thing.
It's almost a compliment to it. Like, it's almost grown. You don't have to rely on these, like, kind of, these, you know, one or two really exciting characters, because we all now appreciate all the characters kind of almost on, like, an equal plane.
And what do you think? The one thing was that they formed this plan. They must be the smartest people in toys in the entire world, because they formed this plan and it worked on the first try, everything. I always wondered about that. The plan, they get Woody's like, "All right, guys, I have a plan." And then it fades to them coming in a circle, and then the next scene is them doing the plan, and everything works literally perfectly. But it's just funny. Like you never see them, like, the Ocean's movies or something. Like, something always goes wrong. And there's like, nothing goes wrong until they get to the Lotso there.
Lotso, God.
And then, dude, when he comes down and hits that garbage, like you're like, damn it, they were so close.
Damn it, Lotso. Damn it.
Yeah, but no, we can wrap this up if you want.
Go see it. Live your life.
Yeah, one of my absolute favorites of the year, and I can definitely see it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what animated movie will even contend. I can't even.
I mean, How to Train Your Dragon was great, but I think this movie.
Yeah, oh, right, was, right, yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, so.
That's the only one.
But, I mean, definitely just a great, time at the movies.
Yeah, so absolutely go see it. All right, and then next week we'll be back. We saw Night and Day, which is really fun. So if you're listening to this, go see it.
Yeah, go see it. Go see it early. Yeah,
full review.
We'll do a little podcast.
And then Grown Ups screening. So
we'll see how that works. We'll see how that turns out.
Yeah. All right. Well, follow the Film Stage for all news updates. And you can follow us on Twitter. You should know it by now.
So. Yeah.
All right. And email us questions if you want. editors@thefilmstage.com.
Yeah, definitely do it.
All right, guys. See you next week.
Have a good night.